Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience, also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So the presidency of Donald Trump has been an enormous challenge to American conservatism. It's not so much that he just took on the establishment, but he has exposed elements in the minds of some of where conservative politics has moved in the past few years that are unstable or unsettling. He has had heated fights with some Republicans, while others have sat still at moments that many who came of age with Ronald Reagan think there should be more pushback to what the president is doing. And many of his positions, the way he has conducted himself in office, have led to debates about what is the future of conservatism in a way that's different than the debates we have after a Republican loses in a campaign. It's not simply can they rebound, but has the president caused irreparable damage to what the conservative movement built over the last few decades. Today we have with us Charles Sykes to discuss his new book, How the Right Lost Its Mind, which is published by St. Martin's Press. We're delighted to have him. He hosted the number one conservative talk radio show in Wisconsin for many years, and he is now a contributor at MSNBC, and he appears elsewhere, NPR, and he has written for many different outlets, and his book is generating a lot of discussion, so it's terrific to have him here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So the book is described as the book of an anti-Trumper often.
That would be true.
Is that a characterization that you accept and that you find useful?
Well, yes, it is, but it's also, you know, I mean, you know, quite frankly, this is a book about, you know, less about Donald Trump than it is about just how horrified I am about what the Republican Party has done and the capitulation of the conservative movement, watching all of that. So I take the frame of, you know, and try to say, you know, we can get fixated on watching the Orange God King and his Twitter storms, but I also want to talk about what he has actually done to the political party, to our political culture, and what the long-term ramifications are, but also how the hell this happened. How? I mean, I was there in the middle of it, and it was a shocking, soul-crushing, disillusioning experience, and I really did need to step back afterwards and say, okay, I have to explain what just happened to this movement and to the people that I thought I understood who were my allies.
What happened, you know, if you study Ronald Reagan in 1980, and whether you supported his campaign or didn't, and there were many people on both sides of the aisle, it was a period where conservatives seemed very invested in a robust debate about ideas, whether it was supply-side economics, debates about national security. Think tanks had formed in the 1970s, and policy briefs were being produced, and this seems very different, where there's almost an adversarial relationship to that kind of idea building. How did we get from there to here?
Well, I think that's exactly what happened here, that this was really a rejection of the conservative mind, of conservative ideas. And what's happened is how the right has morphed from being about ideas and principles to being about attitude and about tribal loyalty. You essentially had years and years and years of conservative thought leadership that were exiled in place of somebody who was basically a gigantic middle finger to the political system. So that was, again, part of this. You know, my problem with Trump is ideological, but also it has to do with his character and his judgment and the style and what it actually means for conservatives to associate even the policies that I agree with, to have them associated with someone like him.
So, but if we go back and look at the primaries when this whole thing was starting to unfold, at the beginning of the primary season, about 40% of Republican primary voters liked him better than anybody else, even when the field was over a dozen people. So how do we reconcile this conservative movement that you say is sort of, you know, not represented by Trump with the fact that he seems to represent a pretty large segment of the Republican Party who likes him best of all the choices available to them a year and a half ago.
Yeah, well, that was mind-bending for me when that was happening at the time.
Was that a revelation?
It was, and it was one of those things where you kept figuring you're going to wake up because, look, you have 16 candidates, rather impressive range of candidates, and yet the voters kept choosing Donald Trump, you know, despite the fact that he had revealed over and over again that, number one, he wasn't really a conservative. He was a man of no fixed principles who didn't think deeply about any of these things, and also embraced ideas and policies that were absolutely toxic and that would have been disqualifying in any other election. So obviously that was a commentary not just on Donald Trump, but on what that conservative electorate really had become and what it was looking for.
But I think there are things that he's in favor of or says he's in favor of that seem to be goods that conservatives and others in the Republican Party have wanted. Certain kinds of jurists, tax cut, undoing of the Affordable Care Act. These are things that Republicans want. So looking at it from the outside, it looks like he's delivering the goods or he represents the goods that people want. So talk about that.
We are at that moment right now where I think that is becoming the conventional wisdom on the Republican Party. In fact, in the last few days, the editor-in-chief of National Review magazine essentially went through, you know, the various conservative policy things that Donald Trump had done and said, look, we should be happy with him. You know, what is the problem? And the answer is all of the other baggage that comes with it, all the things you have to ignore, all of the things that you have to rationalize that come with it. So, you know—
You mean character.
Yes. And not personality, not style. I mean, fundamental character, honesty, his approach to truth, the way, in fact, I think he has empowered and enabled some of the darker elements of American culture. You know, early on, remember, this is a man that launched his campaign coming down that golden staircase by talking about all of the Mexican rapists who were coming across the border, who supercharged his campaign by saying that we ought to ban all Muslims from coming into this country. And at the time, I think this was widely recognized as, you know, these were outrageous comments that were outside of the conservative mainstream, at least the conservative thought mainstream. And yet, as you point out, were embraced by the Republican electorate.
So if we think about, say, the role of factual information in driving political conversation or political or in policymaking, so this all began with Trump, is he the representation of a trend that's been building?
Oh, the dysfunction was a pre-existing condition.
Yeah, so how far back?
He's a symptom.
Right, so he's a symptom of something that's been brewing. Finally, yes. This large segment of the Republican electorate has found their guy, like someone who really represents them, like in some kind of primal sort of way. So it seems to me that segment of the electorate has been there for a while. And you've been doing talk radio for a long time. You've been active in engaging with people intellectually. Was it there 20 years ago?
It was there 20 years ago. Now, of course, I need to make it clear that Wisconsin was an outlier. And this was perhaps why I saw things, you know, why I missed certain things. That, you know, you might remember in Wisconsin, he was overwhelmingly rejected by Republican voters. He was not popular. I would say that by the time the Wisconsin primary rolled around, he had in southeastern Wisconsin, where I broadcast, he had an approval rating among Republicans around 26%. So that part of the but again, national Republicans kept telling me, Charlie, you have to understand that the rest of the country has a very different take, and this is out there. And I think this is part of what I had to go back with the book and go, what the hell just happened to us here, was to realize that what I thought of as the conservative movement, you know, the intellectual conservative movement, you know, the kinds of things that we were talking about, George Will, National Review, The Weekly Standard, Wall Street Journal editorial, we were like this thin crust on top of this sort of molten layer of what the electorate was, that we had ignored a lot. We apparently had gotten out of touch with what was happening, and maybe we're ignoring things. I mean, there were some tells. You asked, you know, how long
these are people who, for instance, voted in a way that was favorable to your interests, and so therefore, well, you know what, they may have all kinds of beliefs, but anyway, they vote the right way.
Yes, yeah, I think that's exactly what happened. So you knew that they were there. And you knew it was like the loudmouth drunk at the end of the bar, but you figured that these were the postcards from the fringe, right? It's your bigoted uncle, but you figured, okay, whatever, he's still your uncle. You asked about, you know, the pre-existing condition. The birther movement. You know, you look back in retrospect. what proportion of conservative Republican voters told pollsters that they believed that Barack Obama had not been born in this country? Now, that should have been a canary in the coal mine.
Yeah, that was about 18%, if I remember, something like that. But close to one in five people.
But among Republicans, it was very, very close. It was very close to a majority in some states.
So that's bringing factual beliefs into line with political beliefs, right?
Like exactly.
Psychologists call this motivated reasoning. Mm-hmm. So the idea, or biased assimilation, these phenomena where you find something agreeable because you already feel that way. I hate Barack Obama, and therefore I'm going to believe what I believe to be a bad thing about him, something
right.
like that.
And of course, on the right, you had this development of these echo chambers, these bubbles, what I've called the alternative reality silos, where that could cook, that could bubble up, it could be reinforced. And for the thought leaders, who ought to have pushed back against that, I think that there was a sort of the moral challenge that they failed, which was throw up their hands. I think Mitt Romney represents, I think, probably the decent wing of the Republican Party. But remember back in 2012, he stood next to Donald Trump and eagerly and enthusiastically accepted his endorsement, even as Donald Trump was in the midst of pushing the birther conspiracy. So that was one of those moments where it was like, we're going to turn a blind eye to what's going on because, the center will always hold, right? This will never overtake us.
Now, part of this story is about these elements of the Republican Party that have been growing. Part of it is the inability now to contain parts of the party that were there, but like a drunk at the end of the bar, you could keep them there. But now they've taken over the party, and it's impossible to put that back. And the other part you keep mentioning, you talk a lot about it in the book, is this media. Why does this have such a big hold on conservatives? Breitbart, Fox News, and particular shows on Fox News. How has that come to shape the Republican imagination? You talk it's not about facts. It's paranoia often. How did this happen?
Well, that's a large story, and as you and I were talking about a little bit earlier, I was surprised going back when I found in Nicole Hemmer's book that she reminds us that when Ronald Reagan was president back in the 1980s, there was essentially no conservative media. There was no conservative talk radio until the end of his presidency. Fox News didn't go on the air until 1996. You didn't have websites like Breitbart until 2006. So a lot of that was relatively recent. And so I think that what happened was you had the conservative media morph from being an alternative to answering the mainstream media to replacing the mainstream media while at the same time delegitimizing anything that came from the fact-based media. So they got to the point where my experience was that I would get stuff from the fever swamps and I would push back and I would write back to listeners' emails, this is not true. And up until 2016, people would accept that. From about 2016 on, what happened was if it did not come from a designated site from within the alternative reality media, they would not accept it. Nothing from the New York Times, nothing from the Washington Post, nothing from NBC. It became a hermetically sealed alternative reality that was impenetrable. And so if in fact, people use their minds in order to find out things that enhance their bonding to their tribe, these are the perfect instruments. And I think that for a lot of conservatives, the conservative media has become their safe space where their bias is confirmed. You mentioned motivated reasoning. They are protected against information that makes them uncomfortable, and it provides them with the ammunition they need. And if, in fact, that media was responsible and fact-based, maybe that would be a positive thing to a certain extent. But I think we saw in 2016 the degree to which they were willing to be irresponsible and turn themselves over to pro-Trump propaganda.
What is it about conservatives, though? I mean, so there's this argument about false equivalency. And so I don't know where you stand. Some people will argue, well, both sides have these silos and both sides have this media. And others say, well, it's gone further with conservatives, where liberals, there's one study that we talked with the author that found that liberals are still more skeptical of their own media and willing
to
challenge it.
Yeah, the guy who tried to plant fake stories with the left, and it turns out that liberals are good at forming a circular firing squad and shooting each other when something comes up that doesn't fact check. And so there seems to be this culture among liberals to to shoot at each other a lot.
But I guess what is it about the conservative slash Republican voter that allowed this to take such strong hold, this media world? Is there something inherent, or is it just they did it better?
Okay, I'm going to admit that's an extremely uncomfortable question. So I'm going to evade it at least in the beginning by saying, look, there's you have to understand there's no question that there are bubbles on the left and on the right.
Yeah.
If you live in Manhattan and you know listen to NPR and you watch MSNBC primetime and you get your information from Salon and Slate.com and the Huffington Post, a lot of what happens in the world is going to come as a big shock to you.
Uh-huh.
So there is a bubble, but there's no question about it that there's something more, and I'm going to use the term again, hermetically sealed about the conservative media. And I really I'm really uncomfortable saying this, but I can't get around the fact that it's reflected in the educational gap is that people who have a less sophisticated view of the world, and by the way, I hate saying this, but I really do, that when they get all of their information from these sources and they don't have the critical sensibility to say, okay, let's compare this to this historical fact or to this other idea, I do think that makes them more vulnerable.
Are you surprised?
And I hate to say this to you.
Yeah.
So, but if we go back to early parts of your career, I mean, you came onto the scene doing talk radio. If I think back about the ways in which these things built, I remember decades ago, riding in a van someplace, and then this voice came out over the air. It wasn't yours, although you have a very persuasive voice. But it's just this voice of this very comforting and persuasive voice. And I eventually, after a while, figured out that I was listening for the first time to Rush Limbaugh. Mm-hmm. And it was a very comforting, authoritative voice. And I just, it sounded reasonable. And then he said things that I was not used to hearing. And I was just fascinated by that phenomenon. And I just want to talk a little bit about talk radio, since you've been so deeply involved in that. To what extent is this either technology or just the way that one can narrowcast, where you can find like-minded people by, say, having your voice reach through the airwaves to listeners in Wisconsin, and then they hear you, and it becomes a conversation between you and them?
Now, this is what's interesting. I want to address this in two different ways. Number one, when people like Rush Limbaugh and other conservative talk shows went on the air in the late 1980s and the late 1990s, they were serving a market that had not really been served. For a lot of conservatives, whether you agree with it or not.
Right, it was pioneering at the time.
They were very pioneering because they felt that their concerns were ignored and they were treated with disdain. And suddenly they turned on the radio and they heard that voice who was talking to them about things that they agreed with, they believed in, took their ideas and their concerns seriously. And it was like pouring water on parched ground. But also remember that AM radio was basically obsolete by then. It was the abandoned strip mall. Nobody was there, which is why—
Disused, cheap.
Totally disused.
Available.
And cheap. So I do think that the mainstream media, does need to engage in the introspection to realize that there would have been no conservative talk radio had there not been an audience that felt that it was not being served. And when I got in about 1992, 1993, what I realized was, there was a real hunger to hear this different point of view. Now, the other thing about
radio—
And to call in.
I mean, the call-ins always seemed important.
Well, the one thing I learned about radio over those years is that radio is different than television and newspapers because it is so intimate. You are the voice in people's heads, and you're engaging in a conversation with them every day. And they get up, and you're talking to them while they're having breakfast, and they walk. So you establish a bond with them that is completely different than what a newspaper columnist is going to have with his readers, or even a television personality is going to have. And then, of course, because it is a two-way communication, you do have that dialogue. But again, had the rest of the media said, okay, now this is a market that we really, really want to make sure that we— that we're tapping into as well. Let's figure out how do we respond to this. I don't think that they would have had the growth that it had. Instead, in places like Wisconsin, I think we had the newspapers basically decide this was nothing we needed to take seriously. Conservatives were a bunch of rubes, et cetera, which of course was this massive gift to the talk show hosts.
And what are they going to do to conserve? One debate, if you read histories of the conservative movement, there's always this debate of how much did an issue like race play into parts of conservatism? And some argued it was there, sometimes through code language about states' rights. Others said, no, that wasn't part of the movement. But now you have a president where it's getting harder to ignore some of the connections.
It's not code.
He doesn't even bother
it's
with the dog whistle.
Right. And certainly that was the impression with Charlottesville. But even without Charlottesville, it's just there all the time, from nativism to race to Islamophobia. What happens to the Republican brand name when this is out front
and horrible.
Exposed?
Well, I mean, that's it. You know, when we started off the conversation, you know, when you asked me about, you know, all of the, you know, conservative policy gains that were being made, except now they have been linked to all the things you just described. Okay, so are we willing to embrace the, you know, the xenophobia and the Islamophobia and all of those things? You know, are we basically in the position of saying yes, but he made the trains run on time? Is this our version of all of that? This is one of the most difficult areas, and I want to respond to it this way, that part of what happened was that for 50 years, and this is, again, very much part of the conservative talk radio culture. For 50 years, liberals had accused every single conservative of being a racist, mm-hmm. right? I mean, Mitt Romney was a racist. John McCain was a racist. George Bush was a racist. Everybody was a racist. You're in favor of school reform, you're a racist. You're in favor of tax cuts, you're a racist, right? So there became a point at which people kind of just rolled their eyes, shrugged their shoulder, and said, okay, you know, this again. They became desensitized to it. So that when the real thing came along without any disguise in the alt-right and the white supremacists, and guys like me would say, by the way, these are really racist, the reaction I got from my own audience was, yeah, you know, this again. This is what they always say
about us. Okay, but that
us.
Feeling 10, 20 years ago, to put it a little bit differently, racists were part of the coalition. So what? You didn't, the conservative movement didn't exactly reject those votes. So let's talk about that a little bit.
No, but again, the flip side is that as a result, as part of the desensitization, is that we became numb to the racists in our midst. I have a chapter in the book called "The Bigots Among Us," and that's one of the moments where I realized, okay, these are the people out there. They've been listening to me for a long time and like, okay, is it something I said or something I didn't say? The Southern strategy obviously is part of all of this story. It's like, let's, you know, they're there and let's, you know, assume. And so, you know, all of that is part of it. And obviously one thing that's been revealed by the era of Trump is the fact that a political party that had taken race seriously never would have embraced Donald Trump. Donald Trump never would have made it to 2016. So the indifference to race at minimum was pretty palpable over the last couple of years.
So does this make the Republican Party a racialist or racist party at this point? I mean, like, now we're talking about the titular head of the Republican Party, the president of the United States, embraces these things. How long does that stick around? Let's say hypothetically he's not around at some point in the future.
Does it make the Republican Party? It means that I don't know how many Republicans themselves are racist, but this is a party that has now been willing to accept this.
I mean, I'm just going to spitball and say 30 or 40% of them. Because they like Trump better. So like maybe they liked something else about him, but certainly 30, 40% are perfectly willing to go along with it.
If you
go to the general election, you know, he seems to have cost the Republicans a few percentage points, but you know, ballpark, most Republicans stuck with him.
Well, and this is part of the disillusionment that I experienced, because there was a very considerable movement on the right, the Jack Kemp, Bill Bennett, Paul Ryan wing, that was really trying to make an outreach to minorities who, after the 2012 election, remember the autopsy, you know, we're doing this. But when push came to shove, this was not a deal breaker for them with Donald Trump. So their acquiescence in this, which I would have thought would have been a moral deal breaker, was one of those moments that you go, okay, there's something fundamentally wrong, that apparently these issues are much deeper on the right than I had realized. And you can accuse me of being naive, but when I saw some of the people who were willing to go, all right, here's a guy that has just retweeted a white supremacist website. Here is a guy who is talking about excluding an entire religion from the country. And this is not disqualifying for you because of tax cuts?
What would it take?
What would it take for them?
Yeah, what would it take for the Republican Party to say, well, you know, he's not really our president. Why don't we get rid of him, you know, put in Pence or something like that?
Well, let's put it this way. Whatever it would take, he's already done. It's already happened. He's already, you know, said the things,
done the
things.
He's already done everything, but the other side of it is not getting policy priorities. Let's say the tax bill crashes and burns.
Yeah.
So now
that part of the exchange isn't.
Well, you know, the deal with the devil
that is,
the
deal.
There's policy
the trains
goals.
Don't run on time.
Right.
Anyway.
We're no longer getting our judges. We're not getting our tax legislation. And boy, the Affordable Care Act is still the law of the land in full. So not getting policy priorities. Would that change the equation?
Not as much as you think. Because the base, for the conservative base, right? I mean, for the Trump base right now, Donald Trump cannot fail.
Because there's a strong.
But he cannot fail. He can only be betrayed.
He can only be failed.
He can only be stabbed. Yeah. Then there will be the stab in the back. And that, of course, will be the political myth that will govern the Republican Civil War for the next 10 years.
Right, because there's a very strong divide that's occurred among people who speak in public, which is on the one side, commentators who comment in politics who don't actually make a living getting reelected. And people who are leaving office or are out of office, that's on one side. And then people who would like to be reelected someday. And as far as I can tell, they're not saying anything.
No. This was an extraordinary moment about a month ago when you had the former president, George Bush, you had John McCain, you had Bob Corker, the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Jeff Flake, all denounce Donald Trump, followed by the complete silence of everybody else in the Republican Party. And that entire decency caucus was on the way out.
Well, I mean, so there's all these policy issues, and I think we have covered them, and you cover them in the book. And then there's this issue of governance. And you could be very cynical about Republicans on the Hill and say, well, as long as the trains run on time or as long as their partisan interests are being served, they're not going to do anything. But I often wonder, Corker expressed feelings that others have about the dangers that happen on a daily basis with this kind of instability in the White House, whether you're talking about war or whether you're talking about simply the institutions of governance and presidency, the whole thing. Why aren't there more Republicans who are feeling a sense of urgency about what's going on? Because this is not the normal. I think we can agree.
I agree.
Why are they – what's holding them back from –
Well, just to put it another way, I mean, just I don't want to seem like I'm panicking, but there are institutions of government that I treasure that I thought would be stable for my lifetime, and they are not so stable as I thought. Not to harp on the judicial thing, but like a judge being confirmed on party lines who's never heard a case. Bills being considered with no with no give and take with the other party. And being pushed through without committee without committee consideration. There are just a lot of things that just are off. And I have to be honest with you, these seemed off, say, 20 years ago when Newt Gingrich became Speaker of the House. That first contract with America was a breathless period that was maybe exciting for a party that was in control for the first time, but it also lacked adherence to procedure. And so I can't help but think that this has been a long time building. And it may be that I'm curious to see how you feel about it, because I don't recall, you know, I wasn't there, but were you complaining about it in the mid-1990s?
No, I wasn't complaining about it, but I was certainly complaining about what we were told was the Democrats ramming through Obamacare, you know, in midnight votes, which seems somewhat ironic considering how fast Republicans—
Can we stipulate that that was not actually the way it was done?
Yes, and we can certainly stipulate—
I mean, it was partisan, but it was not necessarily—
And we can stipulate that what the Republicans are doing now is an order of magnitude more reckless than all of that. No, I agree with you in terms of, you know, all of these norms that are being broken. And, you know, the quote that sticks with me is from, you know, Garry Kasparov, who says, you know, the American system was, we now realize, was an honor system, was basically on the honor system, it assumed an honorable man in the White House. Otherwise, we wouldn't have invested that much power and prestige. But now to find out, okay, so the president can get away with this. The president is—
Because the rules weren't really written down.
Right. The norms were because it was an honor system.
And they were assumed.
And every time you break that norm— Then the question becomes, do you make it easier for the next person to break the norm? And are we in this now, this ratcheting cycle? Or of norm breaking. So I share your concern, and you ask, you know, what will it take? Why will Republicans not do it? Part of it is fear and lack of principle. They won't move until the Republican base moves, and the Republican base probably won't move until the conservative media moves. And all of this, there's also a certain element, and they find this insulting, but there's an element of Stockholm syndrome. That the bullying and the bluster and the threats and the intimidation that is aimed against critics has its effect. They get worn down by it. You know, and I look in the eyes of people who have been insulted and humiliated and ridiculed by the president, and then see that their response is a willingness to do his bidding. And they go, okay, wow, this is not normal politics. But don't underestimate that power.
Yeah, it really is the bully pulpet. And
he's a bully.
He puts the bully in the bully
pulpit. Literally the bully pulpit. But it's not simple. And it's him, but it's the trolls and it's the surrogate. I mean, you just see it day in and day out, this intimidation and aggressive defense of anything the president does, which is changing the climate. I could imagine it quiets dissenters or makes you think twice.
Well, I call them the trolls and the flying monkeys that are released. You know, when the president tweets
what about are the flying monkeys,
the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, when the president tweets about you, say he's attacking you, or he's attacking a reporter like Katie Turr, you know, who's written a very interesting book about all of this. He's not just criticizing them; he's also putting out the bat signal for tens of thousands of other people on social media then to pile on. And if you don't think this has an effect, it certainly does. Also,
I guess you've been getting a lot of attention.
Well, I have, and I've also learned how to mute people on Twitter.
That's a useful function.
And it is a useful function. And also, there's a lot to be said for just not giving a you know what anymore. But I also understand that the business model for conservative media is very, very clear. And right now, there is no business model for a conservative to be anti-Trump on television or on radio. The number of radio personalities who are willing to stand up against this is very small. But also, I mean, part of it is ratings driven. And the Trump base does want conservative media to be a safe space.
Are Republicans, how are they responding to your book? And I don't mean the trolls, but Republicans who you respect, who you have been in communication, are they open to this criticism? Or is it
when the mics are off?
You're becoming a liberal. What's the response? Is there a constructive atmosphere anywhere that this can be heard and read and discussed?
Well, there is that certain that troll thing that you're becoming a liberal and because you're on MSNBC and because you talk to NPR and so you must have sold out. People who read the book know that I'm still a conservative, and it is that there is a tremendous gap between the microphone on and the microphone off.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is the rationalization, the conversation. Okay, I understand, but let me explain. You know, again, the bargain. We are getting the judges. What do you want me to do? You know, am I supposed to vote against tax cuts? Am I supposed to vote? I'm doing the best I can here. I do think that there's kind of a moment where let's get what we can get, and then sooner or later the fever will break. But the problem is that with the passage of time, everybody gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And you asked the question before. How long does this taint last? How do you come out of this at the end and say, okay, by the way, just kidding about all of that support for Trump and our silence about the various things he did? Because I don't think you come back from that.
Presumably that voice will come back if a Democrat does these things.
Well, this is part of the problem. Yes. I mean, let's be honest about it. I mean, everybody is a moral relativist right now, and I do ask as I'm watching Democrats take very principled stands, with which I agree completely in their critique of the president. Will they take the same stand when there's a Democratic president? Or does everybody just switch teams? Does everybody just switch jerseys?
Right. So, for instance, you're pro-life, right?
Yes.
OK. Doug Jones is not pro-life.
Mm-hmm.
Roy Moore is probably pro-life. I'm
right.
Pretty sure he is.
Mm-hmm.
So then what?
I would have no question at all what to do down there. I mean, I would definitely vote for the Democrat.
because you need people of character in office, and sometimes you just got to pick that.
Well, it's a balance. Yeah. And I also think, I mean, from a very, very pragmatic point of view, that if you're pro-life, the election of Roy Moore might set back your movement by a generation. I think there's a lack of long-term thinking here, which is, how is this going to play 20 years from now? Okay, right. So I get a federal judge next year, but I may not get a federal judge for 40 years if I keep going down this path.
Because I would say somebody who, you know, you complain about Mitt Romney being called a racist, or George W. Bush, who appears to be a decent guy in personal life, actually a really decent guy if you look at his stuff about Iraq war vets and his paintings and so on. You know, these are people who appear to be perfectly decent as individuals. But, you know, somebody looking from the outside would say, yeah, it turns out we were right about you guys.
Well, I also think that there's an importance of making distinctions.
Yeah.
That if for example, racism needs to be taken seriously, and the conservatives need to make distinctions too. So, Hubert Humphrey is not Che Guevara. William F. Buckley Jr. is not Steve Bannon. Let's make distinctions between them. Let's let's find the common ground. Let's find the allies, because if George W. Bush is a racist, what do we have left for Richard Spencer? How do we describe Milo Yiannopoulos? How do we actually then distinguish the actual alt-right from the Republican National Committee?
So how does this convert to, say, policymaking? So people don't make deals with the other side very much anymore. Yeah. Occasionally, once in a while, Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray appeared to be able to do something together. But broadly speaking, there is less of that deal-making. Do you see that in Wisconsin? Wisconsin seems to be a kind of a ground zero for polarization between the parties.
It has turned out to be that way. And right now, of course, because Wisconsin right now has one-party government, there is very, very little going back and forth. And there has been that evolution of the sense that compromise and bipartisanship are dirty words, that they're not something to strive for.
It seems to me that part of what will happen, Republicans will have to make choices if they want to move beyond this. So the Alabama race is interesting in that there is an option on the table. People always say, what is a Republican supposed to do? There is an option. Vote Democrat. Don't vote for Goldwater.
Wait for a better Republican after the next term.
But I mean, there are statements. If this investigation turns up bad things and Mueller presents a report that is shocking, what do Republicans on the Hill do? It'll be a choice. There are moments that the party is now going to face where that will dictate whether there's any possibility for reclaiming the traditions that conservatives are still proud of, or do you dig deeper?
And don't forget the tsunami of concern over sexual abuse and sexual harassment, and the gap between society's response to that and the fact that Donald Trump is still in the White House, and the Russia investigation could be the consuming issue of 2018, or it could be the sexual harassment issue that eventually is going to come around to the president who actually was caught on tape bragging about sexually assaulting. But I am afraid the only thing that's going to get the Republican Party's attention, and maybe this is a sign of how cynical I am, it's not going to be the investigation. It will be a thumping at the polls. Mm-hmm. Catastrophic electoral defeat will be enough to shake the trajectory.
So not even law enforcement, because law enforcement seems to be in pretty good odor with Republicans. Mm-hmm. So that would not be enough.
Well, notice how the president has been doing lately.
Undermining the FBI.
FBI, undermining the special prosecutor, and the great fog machine of the conservative media has been aimed on that. So I would not assume, unless it is something really new and dazzling, that Republicans would bail on him because of that investigation.
I see. So losing the House of Representatives, that might do it?
Well, if he loses the House and maybe the Senate, then he stands alone too. So it's beyond the shock of Republicans losing control of Congress. He will be in a perilous political position at that point.
He will be, but then of course he'll have to decide whether he wants to cut deals with the Democrats
and anger Republicans even further.
Which of course then gives us an entirely Trump 2.0.
So that's what is that really what you're scared of?
I've always been concerned, given the fact that I think that he is, that he actually has no principle whatsoever. Actually, what I'm most afraid of is the erratic the erratic lack of discipline that he could tweet us into a thermonuclear war since we're talking about worst case scenarios. That's what I'm really afraid of.
So, yeah, that would be bad.
Yeah, so that would be bad.
On that cheery note, we have to wrap up. So I want to thank Charles Sykes for coming and discussing his new book, How the Right Lost Its Mind, out with St. Martin's Press, available everywhere. We urge you to read it and think about it. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you.
That wraps up our episode. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Take care, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.